and welcome to Dear Hank and John.
Or as I prefer to think of it, Dear John and Hank.
It's a comedy podcast where me and my brother John, we talk about death, we answer your questions, give you dubious advice, and bring you all the week's news from both Mars and AFC Wimbledon. John, how are you doing?
Well, I'm doing all right. I just learned that Merle Haggard died, Hank. As we're recording this, I just found out on Twitter about the death of the great country music legend Merle Haggard. Merle Haggard, who performed one of my all-time favorite country songs, Mama Tried. Whether you know it or not, Hank, you've heard that song. Do you know when?
Yeah, it was at your wedding.
It was at my wedding. It was my my first dance with my mother after my wedding was Mama Tried. In fact, Hank, if you don't mind, if I could just jump right into the poem for today. It's just the chorus of Mama Tried, which is a 2-minute long song. And this is its brilliant chorus. I turned 21 in prison, doing life without parole. No one could steer me right, but Mama tried. Mama tried. Mama tried to raise me better, but her pleading I denied. That leaves only me to blame, because Mama tried. Mama Tried, the great Merle Haggard song. Just a beautiful, beautiful song, and a wonderful song to dance with your mother to at your wedding.
That's wonderful, John. Did you have another poem scheduled that you had to bump?
I did. I had a nice Emily Dickinson poem, but you know what? There's world enough in time, to quote a different poet.
It's true. We're going to keep making these. I think we're going to hit, in not too long, our full year of podcasting, which kind of amazes me. I don't feel like it's been that long. And
I think that would be a great time to retire, to announce our unexpected retirement from podding.
Well, you've ruined it if it was going to be unexpected because we're 10 days early. But
that's a great point.
But I don't think we're going to do that. I really like doing this. I really like that we have people listening to us be idiots. And thank you all for listening. And it's such a wonderful part of my week because I get to talk to my brother for a full hour. And we probably otherwise wouldn't be having these fun conversations.
No, it's true. And I also really love it. This is one of the highlights of my week, talking to you, hearing from listeners. And it's such a supportive listening community. A lot of times on the internet these days, it feels like, things are just so, I don't know. A lot of times, frankly, like my life on the internet isn't as fun and carefree as it used to be, partly because, you know, just my public profile has changed a lot in the last few years, and this place remains a place that's very fun and supportive, and where we can experiment and make mistakes, and we have lovely people to point out our mistakes without being cruel about it.
Yeah, for example, all of the people who pointed out that in our last podcast we discussed parsley as if it was flavorless. Boy, parsley has a lot of defenders.
Yes, Hank, we were totally wrong about parsley being flavorless.
Yeah, mea culpa, parsley fans. I apologize for insulting what is your favorite set of leaves.
Yeah, in fact, we didn't just get parsley wrong, Hank. We got a bunch of things wrong.
Oh, yeah? Are we going to start off the podcast with corrections?
Yeah, we're just going to... If I could just make one more correction before we get to some listener questions. Somebody pointed out that I said that Boris Johnson is like the Donald Trump of England. In fact, this is only true insofar as they physically resemble each other. Boris Johnson is nothing like Donald Trump, and I want to be very clear about that, lest defenders of Boris Johnson, and they are many, think that they are also defenders of Donald Trump, or indeed defenders of Donald Trump think that they also have to defend Boris Johnson, who at least pays lip service to the idea of a national health service.
Yes. Right. I know nothing about Boris Johnson, and so have nothing to add.
My main feeling about Boris Johnson is that I wish that he would say yes to the AFC Wimbledon Stadium. I actually have no second thought about his work.
My only problem with him is that this one local zoning issue, and thus I'm going to compare him to Donald Trump.
It's not a local zoning issue, Hank. It is an issue of great import to the future of our civilization, because I would argue that this whole time what we've been doing is trying to create a world in which AFC Wimbledon can go home. Like, the whole time. I mean, from 250,000 years ago, from the first humans...
That happened.
...building structures with the first tools, what they were thinking is someday, we will be able to build a new plow lane.
We have a question. It's from Lydia, who asks, Dear Hank and John, please help. For the past week, a particularly fierce bird has been dive-bombing my window and ramming into the glass with its beak. How do I stop this persistent fiend from attacking my house? How should I reinforce my window to prevent potential bird invasion?
You know, Hank, in my limited experience with this phenomenon, it's generally a kind of one-time thing, which is that the bird hits the window and then the bird falls dead to the ground.
No. This is a different thing. That's when a bird thinks that it's... That there is nothing there, and it's trying to fly through the window. What is happening in Lydia's case is that your window is slightly reflective, or very reflective, depending on how new your house is, and the bird is seeing in that window a potential rival, and is defending its territory, and is very upset and stressed out by the fact that this bird is not responding to its defense of its territory. And it will continue to attack your window until the season in which this territoriality is over. And that might be just the breeding season of the spring. It might be through the nesting season. It depends on the species of bird. But if you are having a serious problem with this, the bird's not going to be able to break your window. But if the bird is injuring itself, which they will do, or if it's keeping you up at night, you can hang like just some tarp or like painter's tarp that you can get at the hardware store over your window temporarily so that it does no longer is afraid of itself, which is what's happening. I've had this happen to me before several times. Robins in particular do this.
It's funny. I'm laughing like birds are so stupid. But of course, like, I am also afraid of myself. All right, Hank, we've got another question. This one comes from Liz, who writes, Dear John and Hank, my best friend is getting married in October, and we were talking about what she'll do if she's in her wedding dress and needs to poop, because wedding dresses are tricky to deal with. I have a vested interest in this matter since I'm her maid of honor and will probably have to help her with her dress if she does need to poop. So my question is there a healthy-ish way to just not poop for a day? Liz?
Well, John and I... We are both experts on this topic.
You have come to the right place. This is one of the very few times when Hank and I can provide genuinely non-dubious advice.
I did, I'll say before we get to our areas of expertise, I asked Catherine about this because I have never worn a wedding dress.
Sure.
And I was like, how much of a problem would this be? And Catherine had some very specific answers. She said, if you're wearing Spanx, that you should be concerned only if you're wearing the kind that, like, go up around your shoulders, because there's, like, full-body Spanx. Uh-huh. So you do want to be careful if you're wearing full-body Spanx, because that, like, then you have to take everything off in order to poop.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, you can just lift up the dress and bundle it around your front and hold it in front of you.
Yeah, I can picture that.
And sit down and poop like a normal.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get help. You can get help before you go into the bathroom, getting sort of all of the undergarments in order, so that no one has to be in the bathroom with you. But I do agree that it would be best if you didn't have to poop. So, John.
So here's what I would advise. I would advise the morning of your nuptials. Really, even if you're not wearing a wedding dress, just to make it a little less stressful, just to take away one variable, I would advise taking one capsule of Imodium AD. Just one.
Yes.
One should do.
Mm-hmm. Don't overdo it.
Nope.
Don't overdo it.
You may be slightly inconveniencing your future self, but it's just, I think it's great to take a day off from... or half a day off from pooping on your wedding day. I think that's advisable.
I do this during VidCon, by the way, and in several other circumstances. When you like, you just don't want to. You know, you just don't want to. So yes, it is a healthy-ish way to slow down your bowels. And that's what it's for.
Yeah. Now, of course, you don't want to be taking lots and lots and lots of Imodium lots and lots of times, or you can get something called toxic megacolon.
Yeah. Toxic megacolon is a real thing. It's a real word. It is very dangerous.
It's a bad way to die.
And it sounds quite fun, but it's not.
Toxic megacolon. It sounds fun, but surprisingly enough, it's not. Yeah, no, it sounds like a really good hard rock band, but it turns out to be an occasionally fatal,
yes,
terrible disease. So don't overdo it. But yeah, that would be my one piece of advice. We have another question, Hank. This one is from Harrison, who asks, "Dear John and Hank, do you consider yourselves to be Renaissance men?"
I don't want to badmouth Harrison in this circumstance, but that is one of the questions I deleted and was like, we'll skip that one. Because
you know the reason I wanted to answer it?
Okay, yeah.
When we did the very controversial Crash Course World History episode on the Renaissance, I Googled, there's this guy, How Jay Say, and he says every word in the English language. He's very helpful for a pronunciation guide. And so I looked on How Jay Say, how you pronounce Renaissance, and he says Renaissance or Renaissance. And ever since then, whenever I hear the word Renaissance, I insist on like saying, you know, Renaissance is also an acceptable pronunciation. So just the other day, Sarah and I were doing the crossword, and she was like, do you know a Renaissance painter? And I said, do you mean a Renaissance painter? Because I don't really answer to Renaissance anymore.
Oh my God. Sarah asked you if you knew any Renaissance painters because she couldn't come up with any, or because she wondered if you did.
She mostly studies contemporary art history, I will remind you.
Oh, right, right.
She's not an expert in the Renaissance.
I will say, Harrison, the reason I didn't want to answer this question is because I didn't think there was any way of me getting out of it without sounding like a douche. John has just gone and embraced it, just hugged right onto that. went in a totally different direction from where I would have gone, but also still sounded like a douche.
Yeah, my answer is that I do not consider myself a Renaissance man, but I do strongly consider myself a Renaissance man.
All right. Do you want to do a more serious question, John? Get to a serious one?
Yes, desperately. No, I don't. Let's keep it with the silly ones. They're fun and easy.
Okay, well, let's do a more serious one. This one's from Patrick, who asks, "Dear Hank and John, I'm having trouble in my personal life and require a good source of dubious advice. Back in January, my girlfriend walked out on her job for various emotional reasons. Since then, she's moved into my apartment with me, and while that's fine and dandy, I work a minimum wage job, and it's hard to make ends meet all by myself. While my girlfriend is looking for a job, I just don't know if she gets how stressed I am about the situation. I've tried telling her multiple times, and she keeps telling me that she gets it, but I'm unsure about that. How should I go about telling her in a way that she will get what I'm saying? Patrick, I think she gets it. I think probably she gets it.
She's just also probably very, very stressed out about it.
I bet she's pretty freaked out too. A lot of people.
So you probably it's one of those things where you can't really discuss how freaked out you are with each other, because doing that freaks you both further out, because it calls into question this whole sort of like grounded central relationship in your lives. Mm-hmm. And so like that becomes more stressful rather than less stressful, which is not particularly good advice, just an observation.
Yes. I will also say that having a girlfriend who has moved in with you and you are paying all of the rent is going to be a source of stress. It's always going to be unless and until she has a job to help pay the rent.
Or if you're married, you feel like it's the relationship that you want to have, the kind of structure of the partnership that you want to have.
Right. You have to be asking yourself, like, every month you are investing like a lot of money into this relationship. Now, this is a terrible way to think about it, but bear with me.
That is truly a terrible way to think about it. Every month you're investing like $250 in this relationship. I bet that's not the central investment.
But it's something to consider, and to know that that's like that's a psychological thing in your own mind, and that you say it's fine and dandy But is it though? Because clearly you are freaking out about it and you're stressed about the situation. So it's worth asking yourself if you are only stressed out because you are having a hard time paying the rent, or if you're also stressed out because you feel like you are carrying this burden and it is a very difficult burden to carry. But yes, my guess is that this is a very stressful situation, and there is very little as stressful as money problems in a relationship. And I think that it's going to be difficult to be open about it because of how stressful it is.
Yeah. But at the same time, I do think that closing down the lines of communication and not being honest about your feelings are probably not going to be particularly productive. This reminds me in general, Patrick, that Hank and I are much better at addressing whether or not you should take Imodium on your wedding day than we are at giving big life advice.
Yes.
I would say to just try to, you know, try to keep the lines of communication open, mm-hmm. and try to have productive conversations instead of just like, I'm really stressed out about this.
Yeah. Yeah. And also to know that, you know, that the emotional reasons that your girlfriend left her job are probably very real. And the way that you call them various emotional reasons kind of makes me feel like you don't feel like they are super real.
Yeah. I think that's the other thing, is that you've got to have that conversation as well. Hey, can we move on to another very serious question?
Okay, John.
This question is from Lena, and she writes, whenever I'm about to sneeze and I realize that I'm wearing my friend's sweatshirt, I feel self-conscious about sneezing into it. Is it okay to do that? Will I get my friend sick? I mean, first off,
How often are you wearing your friend's sweatshirt?
I mean, I've got to call into question this whole, whenever I'm wearing my friend's sweatshirt. Yeah. Clause.
Yeah, I mean, is it really your friend's sweatshirt anymore?
Right. I mean, once you've worn your friend's sweatshirt three times and your friend hasn't worn it once, it's kind of your sweatshirt.
Possession is 9/10 of the law.
Let me submit, Lena, that you are in fact sneezing into your sweatshirt that you stole from your friend.
The other question is, are we doing the vampire sneeze where you sneeze into your elbow pit? Is that the idea? Is that what you, because other, like, how else do you sneeze into a, are you lifting it up over your mouth?
I assume that she's sneezing into her elbow pit because she's a civilized human being who's read the CDC's most recent guidelines on where to sneeze.
Okay. Well, I'm just making sure. It sounds a little like sneezing into your, like lifting it up over your mouth and sneezing into your body, which is terrifying to me.
Well, I mean, you want to sneeze anywhere other than into your hand, which is the grossest and most horrifying place you can possibly sneeze.
Yes. Sneeze on the thing that you then touch everything with, that I also touch everything with.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Sneeze on your touching apparatus. No, first off, Lena, I want to congratulate you on sneezing into your elbow. That is the correct way of doing it. Secondly, I don't think you need to worry, since this is no longer your friend's sweatshirt. It is clearly yours. Thirdly, you will get your friend sick, but only if they then put their own mouth on that same place in the sweatshirt. And frankly, if that's the sort of thing that's happening, I think that this relationship might be more serious than you know.
All right, John, we got another question. This one is from Akshata, who asks, Dear Hank and John, you may have seen Minute Physics video, Why You Should Care About Nukes, and I wanted to know where nuclear winter falls on John's list of eschatological anxiety.
Thank you so much for the question. It's definitely in my top 10 list of ways that the human species could come to an end, but it's not near the top, just because I think that while nuclear winter could lead to a dramatic reduction of the population of humans, I think that some humans would survive it. It would be like Fallout.
Well, yes, but would you be one of the humans that would survive?
I mean, just look at me, Hank. Do I look like I would survive a nuclear war?
No.
No, of course not.
Definitely
in any
not.
Apocalyptic okay. scenario, Hank, I am going to be in the first 5% of people who die. Like, if there's some, a 1919-style Spanish flu, I'm going to be, patient 7.
that video that Henry made, I for one of the first times ever, found myself kind of disagreeing with a premise in a minute physics video, which is that while we probably will not intentionally destroy all of human life with a nuclear winter, we might do it by accident because we see some sign that someone else is launching nukes at us, and then we will launch nukes at them, and then they will launch nukes at us, and then we will launch nukes at them. And that just, I don't know. I guess I have a little bit more faith in humanity than that.
I don't know that I have much more faith in humanity than that. I mean, the issue, I think the issue is that if a war that uses nuclear weapons begins, and I will remind you that we are less than one human lifetime into the age of nuclear weapons, that war will likely involve a lot of radioactive fallout. Even if it is relatively brief, I think that it would be pretty catastrophic. I don't think that we would be likely to reply to an incoming barrage of 20 nuclear warheads with an outgoing barrage of 200. And I think that's the only way that you really have a sudden apocalyptic event. I don't think that's likely.
Oh, we could definitely do that. If we got hit with 20 nukes, we could definitely shoot out 200.
Well, we could. I just don't think we would, is what I'm saying.
Right, right. You're saying that it's... So I want to make sure that all your eschatological anxiety is in order here. So,
sure.
Interestingly, the fallout isn't necessarily the dangerous part. It's what happens when a large city burns.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just the initial explosion. It's also all of the fuel that will burn in the city and then create, and in all of the cities that. If we are doing a nuclear attack on cities, that's the problem. If we're doing a nuclear attack on like military installations and on areas where there might be nuclear silos, like that's a different thing.
Mm-hmm.
But if we're doing them on cities, first big problem, cities are burning. Second, you create this massive amount of dust that goes into the atmosphere, and even in a relatively small scale attack, where lots of cities are burning, you see, you know, like sort of a 3-year decrease in the temperature of the Earth of like 20 or 30 degrees, which basically means no more food in a lot of places.
Mm.
So that's the concern is not the radiation. It's the collapse of agriculture.
Okay.
And that's something that by the way also could happen with a supervolcano relatively easily. I was just reading an article about how most of the mass extinctions that we have on record were caused by supervolcanoes. And in a way, supervolcanoes are somewhat similar to nuclear winter in the way that they operate. And I just want to say that one of the potential side effects of these large stormy events that have lots of heat on the ground and lots of dust being thrown up in the air is a thing called a hypercane. And I dislike the word hypercane, and I want to make a SciShow about it.
Yeah, I mean, after hearing all of that, I think that I'm going to move nuclear winter to the bottom of the top 5 of my eschatological anxieties instead of the bottom of the top 10. So... congratulations, Minute Physics. You've done it. Also, Akshanta, you've done it as well. I have moved nuclear winter up to 5th in my apocalyptic anxieties. That reminds me, today's podcast is brought to you by Nuclear Winter. Nuclear Winter, one of the ways that we could ensure this podcast doesn't reach its 1-year anniversary.
This podcast is also brought to you by Toxic Megacolon. You thought that it was a really dope band name. It turns out it is a serious disease that you need to be careful with, so don't take too much Imodium.
And also today's podcast is brought to you by the Renaissance. The Renaissance, the only proper way to pronounce the Renaissance.
And finally, this podcast is brought to you by Lena's Friend's Sweatshirt. Lena's Friend's Sweatshirt. Actually Lena's sweatshirt.
I'm so excited for Lena. She just got a sweatshirt. This whole time she thought that it was her friend's sweatshirt, but now we've given her permission to just accept that it's hers now. All right, Hank, we've got another question. This one comes from Julia, who writes, "Dear John and Hank, almost every time I leave the house with my mother, she makes a comment about the sky. Like, it didn't used to be like this. Everyone needs to wake up. The man is trying to control us or the weather." She's kind of obsessed with the man. She is, in general, a smart human, but every time she opens up her mouth and uses the word geoengineering or chemtrails or cloud seeding, I want to roll my eyes so hard. When I Google geothermal engineering and chemtrails, I can't find any legit scientific evidence or studies on it, so I thought, hey, I bet John could pretend to know the answer, and then Hank could step in and astound us with the sciencey knowledge on this subject. So here I am asking if there is any relevance at all to my mother's claims. Should I be joining my mom in her annoyed rants about the man, or should I just let her spew off her nonsense while I ignore from the passenger side? I'm very sorry this question doesn't involve death. I mean, unless geoengineering is real and the man is trying to kill us all with his chemtrail experiments. Sincerely, longtime fan and creator and gifter of the 2011 Swindon Town Swoodly Poopers FA Cup Champions Trophy Plate. By the way, Julia, thank you very much for that. It remains one of my all-time favorite gifts.
That's pretty great.
Hey, I'm not even going to pretend to know the answer to this because I don't even know what chemtrails and geothermal engineering are.
Well, several times you said geothermal engineering when you meant geoengineering. Geothermal engineering is probably the process of building a power plant based on geothermal energy, which is not what we're talking about. Geoengineering.
Okay, what's geoengineering?
Would be the process of attempting to engineer the processes of the planet to control them, to control the weather. You know, it's something that people talk about when, you know, we're like, okay, so the globe is warming. How do we, like, can we dial that back? Because even if we go like 2 degrees up in the short term, like in 100 years, that's going to be bad. But in 1,000 years, it's going to be terrible. So how do we like, we have unintentionally controlled the climate. How do we intentionally control it to maybe make it stable again? And that's a legitimate area of current sort of scientific thought. And there are even some times when we are thinking about actually doing things that would affect the climate. So like whether that's cloud seeding or to reflect sunlight back into the sky or into space, or various other projects that have been tried in very sort of like small scale experiments to see if they actually have an effect even locally. I think that Russia thought about creating a mirror that would shine light down on Siberia, a mirror in space that would shine light down on Siberia and like increase the amount of radiation that area of the world is getting, which would be, you know, also a way of at least local geoengineering. Chemtrails are, if you have never heard of a chemtrail, good. But they are the idea that the contrails that you see in the sky when a plane is going overhead, the water vapor being released from the plane and the heat being released from the plane is creating a cloud in the sky. And the idea of a chemtrail is that that's not a cloud. It is, in fact, some kind of chemical that people are using, the government is using to control us or to try and change the weather or to do something, generally something insidious. That's not true at all. And a lot of people have gotten really connected with this idea. There's a lot of really, you know, exciting conspiracy theories. They are conspiracy theories. It's not real. And those are just clouds that planes make. The clouds that planes make could have an effect on the climate just by being clouds, but they are made of water vapor, not of anything dangerous. That's the situation. Geoengineering is an active area of low-level scientific research. Chemtrails do not exist. They are actually just clouds. But dealing with someone who believes conspiracy theories, who is important in your life, is always hard. And I don't have a ton of advice for that except to just keep loving them anyway.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree with you, Hank, but mostly I'm just happy that you just talked for so long because it means that you might talk more than me in this podcast. I have another question for you, Hank. This is also a kind of Hank-oriented question. It comes from Gerda from Sweden. Could also be pronounced Renaissance. I'm not positive. She writes, "Dear John and Hank, if I, as a human female, were pregnant with kittens, would I be pregnant for 9 months like a human or 9 weeks like a cat? P.S. This is rather urgent." So I don't know why it's urgent. I mean, there's a couple possibilities, one of which is truly alarming. But
well, yes, one of the potential reasons, yes. I'm scared for Gerda. The good news is that it can't be that urgent unless you are 9 weeks pregnant with kittens.
Yeah, not least because you're about to have some kittens.
If you're only 3 weeks pregnant with kittens, then I'm not super concerned. But if you're 9 weeks pregnant with kittens, you do need to go see a doctor now. The situation here is that the pregnancy is determined both by the physiology of the mother and by the child, but you do not want to have any child that is in the womb for longer than it was designed to be in the womb for. The cats are going to have to come out even if your body isn't ready for them to come out, which is fine because we have all kinds of medical procedures that are, you know, not the best thing to have to go through in the world. But we have them, and you can get a C-section and have the cats removed and they will be healthy.
Will they be healthy?
Yes. I mean, yes, they will need you will need to find a nursemaid, a wet nurse cat mother to take care of them, or that would be the ideal situation, or you could bottle feed them with cat formula. But I think it's going to be fine. I do have some questions, though.
I have a couple of big concerns, Hank. Number one, if I implanted kitten embryos into a human womb, would I actually get cats?
You would not. No, you would.
Oh, okay, good. I mean, I was freaking out for a second there.
We are not similar enough for that to happen, unless Gerda from Sweden has some really interesting physiology.
You know what, Hank? I have grown uncomfortable with this question and feel that we should move on. So, I'm calling it.
Okay, we've got another question. This one's from Lorelei John, who asks, "Dear Hank and John," it's a slightly more serious question, so get ready. "Recently, my fiance discovered he has a daughter that he was previously unaware of. Not only did he wait 2 months to tell me about said daughter, but now he wants to postpone our wedding that I did all the planning for. I'm very conflicted. I'm angry at him for not confiding in me, but also I want to give him the time and space he needs. My fiance and I have been dancing around each other for literally like 10 years, and I've been so excited to actually finally get married to him. Now I feel like everything is falling apart. What should I do? Any dubious advice is welcome."
Is this question from a character in the television program The Gilmore Girls?
Dang it! I really was hoping that you would answer it.
What a great question. First off, thanks to the Gilmore Girls for writing in. Always a pleasure. You know, it's funny because when you write a plot summary of the Gilmore Girls like that, my advice would have been, I don't know about you, Hank, but my advice would have been like, I feel like you should probably take 10 to 12 steps back.
Well, I mean, he was unaware of it. So if it had been a secret for your entire relationship, then I would say, yes, definitely take 10 to 12 steps back. But if he's freaking out and he takes 2 months to tell you about it after he finds out, I think that that's not cool. But it's like there is a way of understanding that, like in a relationship.
The main thing for me is that it reminds me that real life, both fictional real life and non-fictional real life, are so complicated and particular that really advice is profoundly dubious. Like even even advice that advertises itself as dubious, like ours, is even more dubious than it seems at first glance. because everyone's life is so specific and so particular, and we don't know the whole truth of your story. And in fact, like, neither do you.
Right.
So, it just reminds me that the whole concept of an advice show is ludicrous.
Right. Well, and also, like, it reminds me that I have to say to Gerda, you know, live your life the way you want to live it. And if you want to have kittens...
God, we're not going back to the kittens. I refuse. Right. Let's answer one more question before we get to the all-important news from Mars and AFC Wimbledon. This question, Hank, comes from Wyman. Dear John and Hank, I am Ty, and here we have more than 20 types of bananas. Bananas are so easy to find here. We grow both intentionally and unintentionally bananas everywhere, even in our own backyard. Stop talking to me about heaven, Wyman. The Cavendish banana is not that popular here. My question is, why is the rest of the world only eating Cavendish bananas when there are several other alternatives which are tastier? On another note, I've seen bananas that are rectangular, triangular, pentagonal, and even ones that seem circular.
We may have cut this part out, but John just said pentagonal. There, he almost said pentagonal, and I wish that you would kept.
I caught myself before I said pentagonal. Good old. That's, you know, Hank. Things come in multiple shapes. You know, they can be diagonal. They can be triagonal, they can be quadragonal, or they can be pentagonal.
I know the answer to this question, if you want to know.
I bet the answer is that Cavendish bananas are hardier, and even though they don't taste very good, they're easy to ship.
Basically, yeah. Not only are they easy to ship and hardy, they are also easy to ripen on command. So a Cavendish banana, you can keep unripe for a very long time and then expose them to a chemical that tells them to ripen and then put them on the shelves at the supermarket. And that allows for bananas to come from a very long way away and still be always and always not spoil before they get to the store, which is quite cool. Cavendish, thank you.
That is kind of cool.
And also, like, I think that the Cavendish banana is quite good. There is something very nice about the simplicity of its flavor, and that makes it, I think, appealing very broadly, whereas other bananas have stronger flavors that are, you know, might be more exciting, but like maybe not best for breakfast every single morning of your life. But I could be wrong. I haven't had all of these wonderful heavenly bananas that Wyman seems to be constantly exposed to and is making me very jealous.
Hank and I are so old and moderate that we even like our bananas to be pretty standard.
It's true.
How old and like risk averse are you? Well, I don't want a delicious banana in the morning. That's how risk averse I am.
Yeah, I just sort of want a, you know, normal, plain, what you might call a vanilla banana. Actually, vanilla banana sounds quite good.
Yeah. Do you have anything that's less tasty? That's what I always say when I call down to room service. I'm wondering if you could make these eggs a bit blander.
Can I tell you a story about room service, John?
Yes, but then we have to get to the week's news from Mars and AFC Wimbledon, not least because the Champions League is about to start.
One time I was in a foreign country and I asked for a Sprite through room service because I was getting food, and they said, lemonade? And I said, no, Sprite. And they said, okay. And then they brought, and then what I got was a wine spritzer. And I was like, well, this is definitely not Sprite. But what I found out was that in that country, Sprite and other drinks like it, fizzy lemon lime drinks, are called lemonade. And now I know that. Whereas in America, lemonade always does not have bubbles.
That is correct. Lemonade always does not have bubbles. Hank, is there? Did anything interesting happen on the cold, dead rock known as Mars this week?
Lots of interesting things happened, and it's always so hard to pick just one. By the way, but if you're aware that Mars has weather, correct, John?
Yes.
So Mars has dust storms. It has, you know, poles, and it's warmer in the middle and colder at the tops, and all kinds of cool weather things happen on Mars, but they are somewhat more rare than the weather things that happen here on Earth. One of the things that happens are dust devils, and we can see the tracks of these dust devils in the pictures that we take. They're very difficult to see, though, the devils themselves when you're looking from the top because they're vertical structures. But Opportunity, the rover, was just taking a picture and happened to catch a dust devil as it passed behind it. And so you can go and see NASA's photo of this cute little dust devil and Opportunity's rover tracks reaching off into the distance. And I just think that it's so cool to see things happening on the surface of Mars as they happen. And it's so nice to have several concurrent missions happening at the same time on Mars. And I'm excited for more and more of them to be there sending us these beautiful photos.
Okay, we'll try to put that up on the Patreon. You can go to patreon.com/DearHankandJohn, and you can support us directly and listen to our monthly pre-show live stream and watch it, in fact, since it is a video. But you can also just see stuff at the Patreon, even if you don't contribute, and we won't be mad. We understand. Your support... The people who do support us allows us to help defray the costs of Nick and Claudia, who work on the podcast. So thank you. As for the news from AFC Wimbledon, Hank.
Mm-hmm.
So you will recall that last week the news was that we were making an AFC Wimbledon movie, which is very exciting.
Yes, that's very exciting.
However, you will also recall that I kind of buried the fact that AFC Wimbledon season more or less ended with a loss to Hartlepool, leaving them in 10th place in League 2,
mm-hmm.
In a game that that was widely believed they had to win. And the reason they had to win that game was because they were almost certainly going to lose away at Wycombe the next week, or Wycombe, or possibly Wycombe. Nobody knows for sure how to pronounce it, as it is a fictional town made up by people who live in England, presumably as a joke. Their mascot seems to be a puffin. Anyway, they are doing quite well in League Two, and so the thought was that we were going to lose that game away, but instead... AFC Wimbledon won that game, and while they are still in 10th place, they have the proverbial game in hand. They have played one fewer game than the four teams above them, which means that if they were to win that hypothetical game, if every team won every game between now and the end of the season, which is now just 6 games away for most teams, 7 games away for AFC Wimbledon, then Wimbledon would end up 7th in the table and would indeed go to the playoffs.
Oh.
So hope is once again alive due to 2 goals from the Montserratian Messi, that man Lyle Taylor, the great Lyle Taylor, the Messi from Montserrat, the Cristiano Ronaldo of Caribbean Islandos. I'm still working on new nicknames for him. I'm not quite all the way there. But he scored 2 goals. And Wimbledon seemed to be getting healthy at the right time. Center back Will Nightingale, one of the best surnames in all of football, is coming back from injury. There's a bunch of good things happening. So suddenly... hope, that thing with feathers that refuses to go away, is back in Wimbledon's lives. And with 7 games to go, it's pretty exciting.
You know what also is the thing with feathers, John?
What?
The mascot of the Wycombe Wanderers, which appears to be either a goose or a duck, but definitely not a puffin. Also, possibly a swan. I'm not sure. It's some kind of water bird.
Yeah, it's you can tell it's a water bird because I think it has a fish in its mouth.
Nope, that's a crown. It's holding a crown in its mouth.
The best thing is that it appears to be pooping a necklace. I'm sure Wycombe is a lovely place, but the mascot of your football team is a waterfowl pooping a necklace.
Not the end of the world.
That's not an insult.
Worst things have happened.
It's just an observation.
All right, John, for our last question, I'm going to give you half a question. Are you ready for half a question?
Okay.
All right, this is from Matilda, who asks, "Dear Hank and John, today is the first day when I have caught up with the entire podcast. Thank you, Matilda, meaning that I will start listening to my brother and me, instead of Dear Hank and John, while dissecting beetle genitalia now. I loved the beginning of this question so much that I had to read it. The rest of the question is an appeal to us to appreciate pennies more, and I have no interest in reading that. Sorry, Matilda, there are some things we will never change our mind on, but thank you for writing in some lovely thoughts."
I would love to know whether Matilda dissects beetle genitalia for fun or for work. Or, you know, maybe it's one of those things where your passion and your career happen to line up perfectly. I will refuse. I will continue to refuse to say anything positive about the penny, which should never be used ever again as it does not in any way facilitate the exchange of goods and services, which is the purpose of currency. Currency has no secondary purpose. It is supposed to make it easier for us to behave in economically rational ways. The penny is a wonderful example of the failure of markets to act in rational ways, and I will not hear any arguments to the counter. It's one of the very few things I feel so strongly about that I cannot even bring myself to read penny apologists. Hank, what did we learn today?
Oh, gosh. So many things. John?
I know. It was a day of learning. It's so hard to distill it into four things.
John, we learned that sometimes a football team can win even when people think they're going to lose to a goose with a necklace hanging out of its butt.
We learned that if you're pregnant with kittens, you shouldn't be pregnant for too long, so I guess that's good news.
We learned that there are healthy-ish ways to not poop for a whole day, and also that nuclear winter is scary, at least to John.
And, of course, we learned that Renaissance can also be pronounced Renaissance.
Or must also be pronounced Renaissance, apparently.
Thanks for listening to our podcast and for sending in all of your questions. You can send in questions to us at hankandjohn@gmail.com. You can also use the hashtag DearHankandJohn on Twitter, where I'm John Green. Hank is Hank Green. You can also follow us on Snapchat. Hank, I've gotten a little bit into Snapchat recently. Hank is Hank G-R-E. I am John Green Snaps, or John Green's Naps, really, depending on your worldview. Our podcast is produced and edited by Nicholas Jenkins. Our intern is Claudia Morales. Rosianna Hulse-Rojas helps out with the questions. Our theme music is by Gunnarola. Thank you again for listening. And as we say in our hometown,
don't forget to be awesome.